The Instructor Podcast with Terry Cook, talking with leaders, innovators, experts and game changers about what drives them.
Welcome back to the Instructor Podcast. I am your marvellous host, Terry Cook, and this is the fourth and final episode in the In Conversation series with Lee Jowett. And in this one, we focus firmly on the DVSA, the standards check, and why Lee has been pushing for change. Now, this conversation centres on a proposal to reinstate full-length standards checks and part threes, not as some kind of weird nostalgia exercise, but because of a deeper concern, whether the current system actually allows us to assess the things that matter. So, we talk about the national standards, assessment versus guidance, how testing shapes training, and what happens when a system designed to improve road safety starts working against itself. Now, this is probably the most challenging episode in this series, and we don't try and simplify complex issues because, well, they are complex. So before we get into it, a quick reminder that these In Conversation series are released early and ad-free for members of the Instructor Podcast Premium, also known as IPP. Now, this is where these longer, deeper discussions live alongside exclusive content, expert sessions, and space to develop as a driving instructor. To find out more in the show notes or go to www.patreon.com/theinstructor. But for now, let's get into this final conversation with Lee Jowett. Lee Jowett, you have been causing problems again and sending stuff to the DVSA. What are you currently proposing to the DVSA?
The same thing as I keep proposing, really, that they return standards checks and part threes to the 1 hour format with the intention that that will allow them to assess all of the elements of the national standards for driver and rider training. Now, I know that not every lesson is going to include every element, but we have three overarching elements of the national standards that lays out the role of a driving instructor. And, you know, it's for want of a better word, it's quite moronic, in my opinion, to have an assessment process that for however many years was an hour long. And it had the examiner assessing all of that lesson, the entirety from start to finish of that lesson, to then take what you do as a driving instructor, three elements to the national standard, 6.3.1, create an environment that promotes learning, 6.3.2, to explain, demonstrate, practice. That's the bit that we always did. That was the bit that was, you know, assessed traditionally and typically. And 6.3.3, to coach, to put those two elements at the bookend of 6.3.2 and the thing that we always did. And then to decide, well, we don't need to see the entirety of it though, and try and keep the car moving. You know, so we need to create safer drivers. That bit that we were always doing was never enough. It was determined, in order to create safer drivers, we need high level communication. Ergo, you need to create an environment that promotes learning. That is about communicating with somebody in a non-judgmental way that sets up the tone of a session so that that person can experience who they are as a driver. The coaching element is about holding a mirror up to them, which again requires high-level communication to help them to see who they are. As a result of raised self-awareness, they can then make safer choices. That framework is perfect. You look at any coaching framework, it includes those three elements. And so for them to have took that, it shows just such a lack of understanding of what they themselves were part of, you know, and what they themselves fully proposed, to then look at that and go, okay, but we don't need to see you do all of it. And then So you look at that and you go, okay, well, maybe they don't need to see all of it. Okay, but funnily enough, their own national standards for driver and rider trainers literally states those three elements: to create an environment, to explain, demonstrate, practice, and to coach. It literally states that these three elements cannot possibly or meaningfully be demonstrated in isolation. Instead, all three elements must be demonstrated in a joined up manner to create what is known as client-centered learning. So therefore, by their own definition, the assessments that they're assessing are impossible and meaningless. And what we're promoting is for them to go back to an assessment criteria that allows for them to see how that environment is created. Mm-hmm. How do we create that environment? Then how do we use that environment whilst they're moving the vehicle? And then what do we coach them? How do we coach them? Can we coach them around the things that come up in that time period, that evidence that they've got? How do we coach them around it in order to create safer drivers? Because we have the perfect, in my opinion, overarching factors. We have the perfect platform to develop really, really high quality client-centered learning lessons. But then when DVSA rip down and tear down their own system so that they can spend 15 minutes making a phone call to driving instructors that they called an engagement call, it's mindless. It's utterly moronic. So that's the proposal. If I'm to go off on a rant, I know it's only a few individuals, but it's enough individuals and trainers that don't understand the proposal and then misrepresent the proposal. Proposal isn't about whether somebody can learn in 45 minutes. It's not about that. The proposal is not about the fact that DVSA state that you can pull up if you need to. In fact, it is because of the fact that they say you can pull up if you need to. That shouldn't even have to be said. The fact that it's said causes a problem. In the same way that if you say to instructors, well, you can move the car if you need to, will prevent driving instructors from moving the car as much as they do. Yeah? It's not about any of those things. It's not about the things that you think it's about. It's about the fact that there's a framework there in the national standards that outlines how we should be teaching. And so we should be assessed on how we should be teaching. How should we be teaching? We should be creating an environment where our pupils get in the car feeling free to say, this is my thoughts on driving. This is my opinion on that. This is how I think that should be done. Because all of those things will categorically be true. And all of those things will motivate them to drive in the way they drive when they pass the test. Our job would then be to allow them to experience it. And that experience might just help them to make safer choices in the future, because it might recalibrate those thoughts a little bit more. It might give them a bit of evidence while we're there to keep it safe. And if we get really good, we might be able to coach them around it in order to create safer drivers. Without that, without DVSA actually taking on board, it's not mine, it's not my national standards, it's theirs. Without them doing that, then we've got various huge, in my opinion, problems. First one being 1,608 people dying that can't be impacted. Second one being, how do you train people? How do you train people when the guidance says one thing and the assessment says another? What do I mean by that? Well, the guidance clearly states that we create an environment that promotes learning and we coach. How can you coach on the move? Well, you can't really, not to any level. You can ask questions, you can get answers. But in order to deeply think, to run things through people's brains, that's really distracting. shouldn't be driving people forwards in speeds in excess of 10, 15, 20 miles an hour, let alone 50, 60, 70 miles an hour, asking them to think backwards deeply. It's not a good idea. So all of those things contribute to a bigger problem where training in this industry will not go where it needs to go, where all of the research suggested that we needed to go over 30 years without DVSA returning to what they stated. It's not about whether somebody can learn something in 30 minutes or 5 minutes. It's not about whether DVSA can assess what they feel they need to assess. I don't care what DVSA feel they need to assess. That doesn't interest me at all. It doesn't motivate me at all. What motivates me is having any kind of chance to, for us as an industry, to have an impact on KSI collision statistics. Can we save people's lives?
I'm going to push you through a little bit more on that, in the way of in the current way it's formatted, what is the direct impact that's having?
The direct impact that it's having in its current format is that it promotes what we've always done, i.e. it promotes an assessment of the wheels moving part of a driving lesson. What is the issue with that is that in any industry, testing, when there's a test at the end of a training, at the end of a training process is the word, but when there's a test at the end of a training process, the test itself largely motivates the content of the training. Now, we can all sit here and say, well, I'm not test focused, and I always use the example, for driving instructors, of the fact that I used to struggle to reverse round corners with pupils because there'd be somebody using it. Now I could choose any corner at any time of day and I'd have no problem. You know, pick a pupil up, we'll go and do this reverse round a corner. I guarantee I'll put my mortgage on it, it'll be free. Yeah. So when they made that change, it impacted on the training. It did. And it always will. And then put that into what I'm doing. Do I spend as much time as I'd like to working on things that really I feel are important to developing instructors when I'm in a car doing some one-to-one training with somebody? No, because I can't spend all of that time, hours and hours and hours, developing their understanding of how to have high-level coaching conversations when the PDI then turns around and goes, okay, so on my part three, and I go, no, don't do it on your part three. Because they're going to turn around and go, well, why have you trained me to do all of that? And I've paid you all of that money and I can't even do it on my part three. So it has a huge impact. And ultimately, the ultimate issue is that then drivers, new drivers, novice drivers going onto the road are going onto the road without potentially the training that they could have had around the things that will motivate them as a driver once they've passed the test.
I think I'm going to attempt to play devil's advocate slightly. In that, I'm going to steal this phrase here, and Chris Spencer's phrase, minimum standards. And there are good people like yourself and Chris Spencer, like I said, that are always going to want to do more. So in that sense, does it matter what the DVSA set their standards to? Because that whatever they set them to, we're always going to want them to raise them anyway.
It does, because ultimately, and it comes back to something that irritated you before about, and I don't disagree, but that, training somebody in a particular way to pass the part three and get in through the door and then taking them that step further. Mm. Because it requires a lot of training to communicate to a very high level, and that high level of communication is what's necessary. If that isn't necessary on a part three or a standards check, and also in relation to a part three, really what's necessary minimum standards is 40 hours of training, then there are issues. There are exceptions. But again, exceptions don't prove the rule. Somebody that I'm aware of as a PDI, I don't even think she's done a part two yet. She's phenomenal. Hannah Stepanova, she's absolutely phenomenal. She's fully taking on board all of the aspects, all of the coaching, all of the behavioral side of. She's absolutely phenomenal, but she's the exception. And whether she should be the rule is another thing because, okay, there's everything on a scale. It's the reality, you know. We can all talk about things, and be dismissive of the reality, but you'd really have to dismiss reality to say that just because DVSA aren't interested in seeing it doesn't mean you can't train people to do it. You can, but that has to be their choice then. They have to choose that. Yeah, and when people are looking at being a driving instructor and training to be a driving instructor, and when people are driving instructors, how many of them are choosing something that isn't strictly necessary? Because I'm going to say the vast majority aren't. So whether we want to just go, well, minimum standards or not, there will be exceptions. But the rule, as is the rule in any industry, is that training follows testing, where people train is where they are tested. And so it's a huge problem. One that they didn't need to create, in my opinion, because they had everything there for us as trainers to go, right, brilliant. You know, this is, it's all there. I'm not even asking them to change anything. Just look at what you've developed. Look at what you helped to propose. Look at what you put together and then train your examiners to assess against it. I think the fascinating thing for me in relation to the national standards for driver and rider trainers and also the guidance that was created for examiners in terms of assessing around client-centered learning, the ADI-1, is that in the national standards for driver and rider trainers, there are zero mentions of the word fault in the role of a driving instructor. Yet when I see feedback from examiners, the most common word I hear is fault. Well, it's not our job. You know, and people say, well, what if they just didn't have to say fault? It could be, you know, either implied or it could be that they use other ways of describing it. No, because train the trainer, which is 6.6 of the national standards, that is a fault-based assessment. So it would be me as the trainer delivering a fault-based training session to a PDI. In two pages, there are six mentions of the word fault, which states that if it was supposed to be fault-based, it would mention the word fault. Yeah. There are eight pages, I think, for the role of a driving instructor and zero mentions of the word fault. The ADI-1, which is the examiner's guidance, there are 68 mentions, I think, of the word fault in the examiner's guidance, but that's for part two, part three, and train the trainer. For part three, there are only four mentions of the word fault in when an examiner's assessing. So one of those is actually in the overall assessment of the instructor, and don't base your overall assessment on fault in the instructor, base it on their overall competence. And then there are two mentions under adapting the lesson, which are around adapting when the fault or weakness undermines the initial lesson, and not adapting would be, yeah. So all of that says that they should not be conducting assessments saying that, well, your pupil got that wrong and you didn't mention it, and your pupil got that wrong and you didn't mention it, because, well, all the evidence suggests that that's not the case. The fact that they're not following their own guidance gives huge problems, because how do we as trainers, I always say, I could train a PDI to the content of the national standards for driver and rider trainers, and they would fail. That's a huge problem. They will categorically fail. I could train them to the elements of the ADI-1 and what's expected from the examiner as per the theory of the ADI-1, and they will fail. 100% they will fail. So it gives us huge problems as trainers.
So is that at the core of your issue, that the test doesn't parry up with the national standards?
It causes a huge problem. It causes a massive problem unless you don't know the contents of the national standards for driver and rider trainers and the ADI one, which I'd suggest that probably the vast majority of trainers in our industry don't. And if they, even if they're aware of the national standards, they don't understand the framework and the purpose of it. Any of us that went on that coaching journey in the early, 2010 onwards, those people that, that have mentioned, but again, the likes of Ray Seagrave, Stuart Lockery, Fiona Taylor, Terry Left, Terry Kev, Mick, and all, all those people that were doing those things at the time. We understand just by looking at the national standards what that is. So, that's a framework for delivering client-centered learning lessons or coaching sessions, really. It's a framework for that so that you can use it. You create that environment, they get the experience, and you coach them around it so that they understand themselves better. That's what it is, the national standard. Because people don't understand that at all, they either don't know the national standards, or even if they read it, they don't understand the purpose of it. They don't know why it's so important, but it is. It's essential for it to work, for the things that, for client-centered learning to work. That has to be the framework. And whilst I mainly, when I listen to Chris Benstead, nod my head in agreement on a massive basis, I disagree with the fact that it shouldn't matter. Okay, maybe the shouldn't bit, you could go, okay, yeah, I agree, it shouldn't matter, but it does. The fact that DVSA don't even know their own publications is a huge problem to the industry unless you don't make it a problem. How do you not make it a problem? You don't know it anyway. You're not aware of it and you've no interest in it. If you know it, you're aware of it, you understand it and you believe in it, it gives you a huge problem because you have to take all of that and go, that would be so great, but I just have to ignore it,
Two-part question then. What has the response been from the DVSA? And what has the response been from driving instructors?
So DVSA currently don't have our third proposal, simply because we don't know who to send it to yet. There's nobody there yet to send it to. But we have sent two previous ones. They were met with initial interest, but didn't get any further than initial interest, because then you've got those people in the positions that they get passed to, that really it surprised me to an extent. It shouldn't have, but it surprised me to an extent how little regard they've got for that guidance, for that that document. I've spoke before, but I'll mention it again since we're talking about this proposal. I had a meeting just over the road with 40, 50 local instructors and the former head of ADI, who's now retired and delivering training in this industry. He didn't even know what was in the contents, contained in the contents of the syllabus, unit one of DVSA's own syllabus. I had no idea. And then went on to say, but he doesn't need to know that. That's not his department. He doesn't, he doesn't need to know. And then also, someone who I know is really highly regarded in our industry by so many people and organizations, associations, but, John Sheridan, turned around to me at the DAA conference last year, and I put to him the three overarching elements of a driving instructor, and I said, 6.3.1, 6.3.2, 6.3.3, explained all the three elements, and he said, yes, but unit six is train the trainer. I said, no, it's not. that's the role of a driving instructor. I've just outlined to you the role of a driving instructor. And his response to that was, yeah, well, I don't need to know that anyway, because I can tell within 5 minutes whether somebody's any good or not. And that really, that was a bit of a light bulb moment, because what it said to me is they were part of all of this. But then when it came to them themselves, they looked at it and went, yes, but we don't need that. We know our roles already. That's for them. And in turn, over time, that's then created this huge problem, or huge, at least in respect to the fact that we've made no progress. Because actually, when they looked at what they did, their ego said, I don't need that. You know, John Sheridan's ego said, I don't need that. That's not for me. I know my job. I can just go and continue to do my job as I've always done it. But what they were assessing was intended to be different. There are no mentions of the word fault. There are only 4 mentions of the word fault in the examiner's assessment criteria. And really, it's about when the fault or weakness undermines the original lesson. Outside of that, they should be seeing a development lesson where the pupil's encouraged to explore their own thought processes, opinions, values in a safe environment and coached around it. That's not happening. That's not happening at all. And it certainly isn't happening on part threes and standards checks. I've told the story of my last standards check, but at the point where my pupil literally turned around to me and said, yes, I think I do. When I panic, I take risks I wouldn't normally take. That the examiner tapped me on the shoulder right there and then and said, we need to get the car moving.
I said what?
We need to get the car moving. Mm. I mean, that is, she's literally saying, this is how I'm going to kill myself in a vehicle. Yeah.
Mm.
And at that point, at the point where she states how she could kill herself in a car, the examiner felt we should move the car. Not have more discussion around it, not help her to be more aware of it. Just move the car, do some more junctions.
Most instructors wait until they're burnt out, fed up, or questioning everything before they change anything. Now, premium isn't there just for that moment. It's there for before it gets that far. Now, there's no tie-in, there's no pressure. You can dip in, use what's helpful, and leave if it's not right for you. But the instructors who get the most from it aren't in crisis. They're proactive. They're investing in themselves while things are going okay so that they stay that way. You don't just need to join because something's wrong. You join to make sure it doesn't become wrong later. So if you want to take a close look, the details are in the show notes or head to patreon.com/instructor. But for now, let's get stuck back into the rest of this episode.
It's interesting. I think when I try and think of an analogy to it, it's like I look at the L test and the problem we have with learners, which is they come along and basically just need to don't do anything dangerous for 40 minutes and stick to law. That L test, when you break it down, is really, really easy. It's a lot of it is nerves and stuff, as we've spoke about, that cause you to fail, not skill. So we have that struggle with learners, which is how do we need to convince them that they need to drive better than that.
Hmm.
That's the whole thing. And then whether that's skill, whether that's mindset or whatever that might be. And it feels like that's a similar problem here. We've got with PDIs and ADIs, I suppose, as well, in that, well, like you said, I don't need to learn that because I'm not going to be tested on it. Is that the biggest thing, the biggest challenge for a trainer now, is that we now have to convince, potentially, not all obviously, but convince some PDIs and ADIs that, yes, you need to learn this, even though that's going above those standards, you need to learn this.
Because I think ultimately, percentage-wise, it's such a huge percentage of what would be necessary in training for that to actually work. You know, we're not talking about an extra 5 minutes in a training session. We're talking about a 30-30-30% split of what should be trained around. It would necessitate a huge change in the training models of most trainers, if that was to be the case. And so, is it possible. I think it's what's the word that I'm looking for? Naive. It's naive to think you can split those three elements into 30% when the testing process at the end of it doesn't want to see any of that, or really any of that. And when, you know, we're dealing with minimums, and yes, we can all do more, and yes, we should all do more, and 40 hours isn't, but still, you have that expectation throughout training that that 40 hours is going to be this number. You can't split that down into 30, 30, 30, or 33, 33, 33. So, yeah, it won't work. It won't work. So you're left with a situation where you probably better. I'm a massive advocate of being better, you know, and going beyond and pushing beyond. But it's if you did training in that manner, 30, 30, 30, with what people's expectations are, you probably won't be leaving them in a good enough place in any of those places to really be helping them. I think the whole thing needs an overhaul. I think the whole thing needs to be, if they're asking us to do what they're asking us to do, but not assessing us in that way, you know, if they're asking us to do what they're asking us to do, then the whole thing needs radical overhaul anyway. It's nowhere near close enough. But I think, I think it's reality. I don't care what anyone says. It's reality. The reality of any situation is that when you have a test that assesses certain criteria only, that influences what really, you don't have to say this, but let's have a chat about this for 10 minutes and you'll get a better understanding. But it's not, we're not talking about 10 minutes. We're talking about a really high percentage of that training that needs to go towards developing people's ability to communicate at a very, very, very high level. And even then it takes time.
So this is the third time you've put in this proposal. I didn't see the second one, admittedly, but I did see the first. Is it the same proposal, essentially?
Essentially, it's trying to, it is essentially the same proposal, because I believe in it and I won't stop believing in it. But it's just trying to kind of attack them in a different way, if that makes sense. Mm. So we've had to go it through this little thread and we've had to go through this little thread. This time we're going at them through the National Occupational Standards, because also written in the, National Standards for Driver and Rider Trainers in Role 6, Unit 3. It states that these elements were used to develop the National Occupational Standards, and that these standards are followed for trainers and training providers when they're writing training courses. So that's the thread that we're tugging at this time. The fact that if I follow your National Occupational Standards to write a training course to be a driving instructor, and that course is then followed literally by the person that's received that training on their test, they will fail. So therefore the training is not fit for purpose, because it aligns with your guidance, but it doesn't align with your assessment. The assessment has to align with the guidance. It has to align with it. Otherwise, you can't create a training course. So that's what we've attacked them with this time. I'm imploring them to see some reason, because there is a very real, in my opinion, possibility at some point that a PDI or a training company looks at the legalities of a situation where they've failed, they've been unsuccessful in an assessment that's already been deemed impossible and meaningless. Of course I failed. You literally said here that if I do what I had to do on that assessment, it would be meaningless and impossible. Well, I've had to do it because that's what your examiner said. They asked me to move on when I was trying to coach. They didn't want to see how I created the environment. And so all I did was that middle bit. Well, you've just said that that's impossible and meaningless. And then you take that and take it a step further. Well, I was trained by this company. And this company provided training that was written from the guidance in the National Occupational Standards. And that company goes, well, hang on, we trained them as per that. And they did that we trained them to do. So we're pulling at them from that direction because potentially it could lead to huge problems for them in the future. If they don't drop their egos, which is what it's really about, you know, examiners' egos, we know what we need to do. But do you know what you need to do in terms of saving people's lives and creating safer drivers? And I think that the conversation really is in, are they willing to develop and educate their examiners away from the L-test criteria, away from the moving vehicle part, into the things that would create safer drivers?
I would hazard a guess that it's fairly obvious what you want from the DVSA on the back of this. But regarding, say, people listening to this or anyone that sees your proposal on social media or wherever it is, what would you want them to do off the back of this?
DVSA or?
Anyone that hears this or sees it online.
Okay, yeah. So anyone who hears this and hears it and understands it, well done. What I would like anyone to do that understands it and takes on board the message and really agrees with it, I would like you to share that proposal to write to your local MP and implore them to put some pressure, you know, into the Department for Transport, those in a position, because there are some people in a position, friends of mine that I know, that aren't as interested in it as I would like them to be, even though they fully understand the concept of it and where it comes from and its purpose and the impact on road safety. If not, I would like them to take more of an interest in it. If I'm honest, I really don't understand why they don't, but they don't. So, okay. But nothing will change unless something changes. And in order for anything to change in this industry, it's going to require people pulling together. We need to align. I've already stated that I feel like, because of what's written in the national standards and the way that it's written, that there is a ground for pushing this, because it states that it's neither possible or meaningful, because it states that it's the ground, it's the grounding of any course that's on, basically the QRF, Qualification Regulatory Framework. So because of those things, it really gives an opportunity for it to be pushed. It's not even really just my opinion, although my opinion is my opinion. It literally states in the guides that gives us something that we can use. So I've already said that I don't care that it's mine. I don't care if it ends up not being mine. I don't care if some association turns around and says, we see what you mean, we do think that there's a case, but we'd like to push it ourselves. We feel like we can do a better job, and we feel like we can take it and rewrite it and do something better with it and put it to DVSA. Absolutely fine. Brilliant. You know, more than fine. I don't care. This isn't about me. This is about, when I look at that, I cannot read it without going, how is that possible? It's a complete injustice. And I need it to change, and I believe in it. So I don't care whether it's me that ends up getting anywhere with it. I highly doubt it will be me that ends up getting anywhere with it. I would be shocked if I get anywhere other than thank you for your proposal, and we see what you're saying, but is about the best I'll get. On the flip side, I can't justify me delivering workshops to people and saying, like I had to say last week, yeah, this is important for saving people's lives, but don't do it on your part three because they don't want to see it. Without then following that up with, I am trying to push for change. I am trying to do something about it. Whether that comes about or not is another matter, but how do you sit there and do that without going, well, I am trying to do something, you know, and knowing what you know is written? So I think, what would I like people to do? Get behind it, please. It's well-intentioned. It's based on facts. It's factual. And the reasoning is aligned with what anyone in this industry really, in terms of creating safer roads, is promoting. It's not at odds with anything that people are promoting in terms of creating safer roads. So, yes, I would like people to either get behind it, or if not get behind this, do something themselves to push for change.
I think it's a really interesting, and I think I agree with the proposal. But you made a really interesting point, I think, and that I want to touch back on as well, around why other people aren't getting on board with it necessarily, like the other prominent figures or organisations, because I think we've spoke about that quite a bit there. So I think this is an interesting little bit to add on, because I'm going to try and use an example, which is, have you signed up for the emergency stock campaign?
No.
Okay. So the emergency stock campaign, for anyone that doesn't know, is a campaign that's run, I've actually forgotten the name of the charity, which isn't great. But it's a charity that is aimed to reduce abuse wider societal abuse. And part of that is they've had people come forward to them that have been abused by the shooters, have been stalked by the shooters, stuff like that. And the Emergency Stop campaign is basically to campaign against that, basically. Mm. And that's something that, despite now we completely forget the name of the organisation, I have been campaigning for this year. And very few people are on board with it. And so it's a similar thing in something that I believe in, something that I believe is important. But this is what I've learned over the past 5 years. And maybe this is a negative in the industry, I don't know. But everyone's got their own projects. Mm. And it's not that I don't think your project is worthwhile, or you don't think my project is worthwhile. It's that we've only got so much brain space. And we've only got so much capacity to go, yeah. So when I see a project by person A, B, or C, I will often go, they've got that. And believe it, I might drop a message, I might drop a like, I might drop a comment, whatever, but it's like, yeah, they've got that. I'll leave that to them. What I found over the past few years is that if I want someone to help, I have to reach out.
Mm-hmm.
And if I use the association as an example, obviously I'm on the committee of the ADIJC, but there is also the MSA and the DIA. Figure out those acronyms as you want. My suggestion to you would be just to reach out to them and say, can I propose this? I know someone on the committee of the NJC, you know, and but obviously you can find anyone that you can reach out and say, can I propose this? Will you take a look at this? Or can I have your backing? Can we work together? However you want to phrase it is irrelevant, because I genuinely think that we're in a place in the industry where there's that much going on. I hate saying this, by the way. We can't expect others to support us. We have to go to others and ask for help. At least that's my take on it.
Yeah, I agree. Already done. Didn't get me far. So... I won't stop with it, because one day somebody might listen to it, but also I have to justify, you know, I have to, in my head at least, I have to justify the training that we deliver, because none of our training, even though we run a standards check and part three client-centered learning workshop, it's not based really fundamentally around the standards check or part three. It's based around the skills, knowledge and understanding that are necessary to create safer drivers, and then linked to competencies and elements of the national standards, the 17 competencies, etc., etc. But when we deliver those to people, and the only reason that we, you know, that I don't just do, or we don't just do a client-centered learning workshop, is something we've talked about already, which is the fact that you have to be able to sell it. And people won't buy it, generally speaking, if it's not around standards check and part three.
That's still my mission. It's like my own personal thing is, it's like every time, can I do this about mentioning the standards check? I would actually say that I've been quite successful with that. There are times it's failed, I'll be honest. And the standards check does, my biggest episode this year was the one where, the only time I've ever done a full deep dive on it was the Oldmoat standards check. That's been my biggest episode this year. And to be fair, not by a wide margin, but it has been my biggest episode this year. But yeah, I still work off that premise, so I avoid it as best I can. That's not true. It's a small part of what I do, but that's just I think it's just me being stubborn now, if I'm being honest. What do you think of the competencies, the 17 competencies?
Overall, I think they work. I think they work in the order that they work in. I think the, you know, when you work through from the top one and work downwards into risk management, you know, even just the lesson planning, the better you are at planning the lesson, the better your risk management will be. The better your risk management is, the more able you are to showcase your teaching and learning strategies. So even, you know, but going to the individual competencies, identifying the needs of the pupil, that's what we should be focusing on. That's how you develop somebody, because needs can be anything from a lack of skill and knowledge to, you know, the way they react in a particular situation, the way they react when they're under pressure, the way they react when the friends are G-ing them up, the way they react when they're stressed, when they panic, you know, like my pupil. And then, you know, structuring the lesson, because your structure should be based around the need. You to deliver a different lesson to somebody who doesn't know how to do something in a different way than you'd structure a lesson to somebody who panics in certain situations. That then leads into you setting your practice areas up, and then the ways in which you might adapt the lesson. So when I worked through it, it did the good, you know, and they fit the assessment as it is, and they could potentially fit the assessment as, you know, as I would like it to be. And I would like to add a competence in that would address, you know, people's responses and motivations if and when they are demonstrated. So that would go into teaching and learning strategies and make up potentially an 18th competence. So I like them. I think they're fine. I think you could add a bit more person element to it, human elements to it. But I think, you know, it's the teaching and learning strategies. So, you know, it's about the strategies you use to develop somebody. Does it necessarily mean that you can't, you know, develop the human side of them? No, of course not. You know, was the pupil encouraged to analyze problems and take responsibility for the learning? It could fall into that, you know. So I think the competencies have got what they need. I like them. Do I agree wholeheartedly with the way examiners use them? I don't think so, because for me, I think you've got lesson planning and risk management there. You know, them two things are essential. But I think based on what I see, teaching and learning strategies are very much secondary to those other two in that they dictate and determine the teaching and learning strategies and the marks that are given. And I would like to see far more relevance placed on teaching and learning strategies away from, well, your pupil did that and you didn't tell them that, so therefore your teaching and learning strategies weren't good.
I really like the competencies. I think in particular the brackets of them, so that, you know, your lesson planning, teacher and risk management, I think that they're a really good basis for a good lesson. But I'm going to just completely change the subject now, because I want to mention that you were one of the highlights from my year this year, but also one of the reasons why the podcast ended that I'm not mentioning before, because I've achieved something now that I can't surpass, because you're one of my, I mean this in the positive term, one of my critics, in that I will often get a message from me saying, I like, you know, this episode was good, Terry, but I didn't like this, or I didn't like this, and I'm like, but I recently got a message from you that just said, great episode, and it was the Ian Edwards episode. Mm. And he said, love the Ian episode. I'm like, don't get better than that now. There's no critique on there. It's just that. So one of the highlights for me, and it's like, well, I might as well wrap a podcast up now. But no, I appreciate you coming on, Steve. It's been a cracking 4 hours. And I don't know, I think I love talking to you, because you're one of the people that offers me a different insight a lot of the time. You know, you're someone that reaches out to me. I don't think often's the right word, but does reach out to me and will say, is there a problem with this, or, you know, I like this or whatever. And I think the industry needs more voices that are willing to be positively critical as well as just be positive, as much as I do endorse on that, but a nicety now and again. But well, no, it's been a smashing 4 hours spending some time with you. So, you know, big thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you. I mean, I really appreciate the time. Appreciate the time that you're going to have to spend then editing out the amount of people that came to the door and the dogs barking and et cetera. So apologies for that. But yeah, really enjoyed it. And let's keep raising the standards.
Keep raising standards. There we go.
There you go.
The Instructor Podcast with Terry Cook. Talking with leaders, innovators, experts and game changers about what drives them.